Hello there, John.
Hey, Bill. It's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. This is the Week in Blog, regularly hosted by myself, Bill Scher, and the Heritage Foundation's Con Carroll. But we do like to rotate in other illustrious bloggers from time to time. And, John, why don't you tell the Blogging Hits posse a little bit about yourself?
I am not illustrious, but I am available. My name is John Hinckley. I have blogged for many years at Q&O.net. Worked for George Allen briefly. Worked in the...
All the stories you must have.
Oh, you have no idea. it was one of those campaigns where, you know, we came in at... They brought me in after the Makaka incident to try to do some online communications. And we were successful insofar as we were able. We were not terribly able to, you know, it was one of those things where you woke up every morning and thought, all right, big, oh, God. Well, let's see what we can do about this. Yeah, things happen. Worked for the Senate.
Do you feel that he should have been president?
I never had an opinion about that.
Okay. Continue with your...
I think it would have been interesting to see where that went, but I never had a strong enough sense. I worked for the Senate Republican Communications Center for a while in 07, then left there to go work for New Media Strategies, where we did consulting for the Fred Thompson campaign. Continue to work here at New Media Strategies, and now have a blog called TheNextRight.com with Patrick Ruffini and Soren Dayton.
That's an all-star conservative blog you got there.
Well, thank you. I'm not a conservative, but thank you.
What do your compadres say? Do they say conservative or Republican or libertarian?
I think they're a little bit of each. I would hesitate to define them too carefully, but I think they probably fall in each category to some extent.
All right. Well, shall we get to it?
Let's do it.
Well, I've been very focused on these new coastal drilling proposals from John McCain and George Bush lately. I've blogged about it a number of times on my own Campaign for America's Futures blog. Basically, going into the Energy Department data and finding out that there actually isn't all that much oil off of the coasts and in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to actually make a dent in prices. The Energy Department estimates that the 10 billion barrels of oil estimated in ANWR would knock the price off of crude 75 cents per barrel in 2025. Mm-hmm. The price of crude, dollar of crude translates into about 2.5 cents per gallon at the pump.
Right.
So 75 cents of crude, that's about 2 cents at the pump. Again, in 2025, you got 18 billion barrels off the coastlines. That's about double of ANWR. I can be generous and make that 4 cents a gallon. So you got a total of 6 cents a gallon a couple decades from now. And even on top of that, Joe Rahm over at Climate Progress, he found a different Energy Department report saying don't expect any price impacts from the coastal drilling on the Atlantic and the Pacific. Don't expect any price increases until 2030. So it didn't make sense to me that George Bush in his address said, I know in the long term we should be getting off of oil, but we need to do something in the short term for oil prices. It doesn't add up how this would impact oil prices. What are the conservative bloggers saying about that? I noticed Michelle Malkin went to town on John McCain, mm-hmm. calling him Kerry-esque for going back and forth on coastal drilling, on the windfall profits tax. So is he getting any love from other conservative bloggers for his new position?
Well, people on the right are understandably burned by him over the last many years. They feel he has either been unreliable or that he's, you know, stabbed them in the back on a number of occasions. You know, I think he has genuinely been, you know, independent or a maverick or willing to break from the party on some important issues. That is to his credit or to his discredit, I guess, depending on where he stood on those individual issues. But I think he's probably reaping a little of what he's sown in recent years. On this issue, most of the rightosphere is sort of welcoming him back. I think people understand, really, that, yes, you know, drilling in ANWR is not going to solve the problem. And I don't think that's what anybody is arguing. I think that they are arguing that that is a marginal, incremental step in the right direction. Any particular single place you dig is not going to contribute an awful lot to the price or to the global supply of oil. but every one of them contributes incrementally. So it's hard to say. You know, the left has been saying for decades now, don't drill or don't go down this particular energy route. And the cumulative impact of that, it makes a great deal. Sure, it might not have an impact for 10, 15 years, but that was also true 10 or 15 years ago. At what point does that, you know, the short term does eventually become the long term?
Well, the left also was saying 10 or 15 years ago that we should be investing in renewable energy and energy efficiencies, and that's a line that was adopted by George Bush from the beginning of his administration. Every single State of the Union address he has given, 01 to 08, talked about getting off of oil and ramping up on renewable fuels and energy efficiency. And yet when he was in control of the White House, the conservatives controlled Congress, there was nothing significant done on those fronts. So I think it's harder for him to deliver the message now that we need to do more short-term drilling when he had 8 years to do long-term stuff that wasn't fossil fuel-based and it wasn't done.
Yes, I mean, if you're looking for the Manhattan Project, yeah, perhaps they could have done more on that. The administration has provided a lot of incentives over the years for companies to do their own investments, and I think that's not flashy, as flashy as a Manhattan Project, but it is having results, and a lot of companies have been investing in a lot of the new technology. The technology you see coming out now, the advanced higher mile per gallon vehicles, things like that, those have been in the pipeline for many years now. That's not a new product.
I think the issue now is to get these technologies commercially available and affordable. The technology is already here, but how do we kickstart that so it's actually accessible to the average family?
Well, there's a number of different problems, and I should disclose at this point that I do have a client who is somewhat related to this, but there is an infrastructure problem where we just don't have the infrastructure internally to make it worthwhile to consumers to buy a lot of the products that do exist. And, of course, the public wants what it wants. You can put out all the 50 mile per gallon electric cars or higher electric cars, but if people want to buy SUVs, that's what they're going to do. Gas prices have done way more to drive consumer demand and to change driving and purchase habits than regulation has. And that's going to be true going forward as well.
Well, the problem with that is, unfortunately, there's now a gap between the high gas prices that are prompting a desire in consumers to change behavior with a lack of access to the energy-efficient vehicles and alternative fuels to help you change behavior. So then you're stuck paying $4 a gallon gas to get to and from work in the suburbs, and there's nothing you can do about it. So there is consumers don't have the choices available to them to make these sort of decisions.
Well, I think they do have the choices. There are something like 80, or close to that, 80 alternative fuel vehicles available in the U.S. today. The problem is that consumers have not really been demanding those for a long time. That's changing now. The other issue is that there is a very low elasticity problem in the short term. People cannot change their habits, change their purchase and driving habits over the very short term. Over the long term, they change dramatically. And we're going to see that for some time. You know, you can't turn around tomorrow and say, gas is a little higher than I'm comfortable with. I'm going to totally change, you know, how far I drive and what I drive. But the next
time you buy
a car.
I purchased a hybrid in the fall because my hand was forced. I had a car that was on its last legs, and to fix it up to meet inspection was going to be too costly. So I had to get a new car.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I have a middle-class salary, I wanted to get a hybrid. I was willing to put more into that purchase than maybe the average family would feel comfortable doing. But the fact of the matter is the Prius is an expensive car. Mm-hmm. There's a premium you have to pay to get a Prius. It's more expensive than you would a comparable vehicle. And the tax credit was in existence, but it was very paltry. I had a $780 tax credit for a car that cost $21,000. That wasn't a behavior-changing tax credit. So, but the fact of the matter is, the Prius now has waiting lists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hard. The consumer demand is there, even with the car as expensive as it is. If you had an energy policy that really had a generous tax credit for those vehicles, they would go off the lots even faster.
Well, they would go off the lots about as fast, and they are right now about as fast as the manufacturers can make them. There is certainly to some extent a bottleneck problem, especially when demand ramps up relatively quickly, and driving habits and purchase habits are changing right now. But that's being driven by gas prices that are high, and people expect they're going to stay high. You know, when gas prices were up and down, that didn't change driving habits very much. But now that people believe they're going to stay high for a long time, that will continue to change driving habits. And it will also continue to drive the kind of investments that auto companies are making in what they're developing in the future. There's a five-year timeline between concept and actual deployment of autos. So, you know, the things you're seeing on the road now is what they were thinking about 5 years ago. So, you know, 5 years from now, it's going to be dramatically different now that they have the built-in expectation of you know, an incentive for consumers to change their habits.
So how do conservative bloggers see McCain's moves politically? Do they think it's going to, regardless of how they feel about the man, do they feel he's onto something politically that's going to be a benefit to him to make up ground in the general election?
Yeah, I think that you're seeing a lot of right-of-center bloggers push the Newt Gingrich organization, American Solutions, message, drill here, drill now, pay less. I think they believe that is certainly a winner. The American public, I'm not sure how intense they feel about this, but the people generally like the idea of drilling or finding new sources of oil, tapping new sources of oil. Now, whether they believe this particular policy that McCain endorses will help in the short to medium term, I don't know. But I think the right of center sees this as a winning issue.
See, I would if I were McCain, I would worry that he didn't learn a good lesson from the gas tax holiday, where something that probably polled well when they checked on it privately or at focus groups or whatever. But then when the rubber hit the road and there was a counter argument that, you know what, this actually isn't going to result in a lot of savings for people, I think the public is there. The ideological blinders are off on people when it comes to this issue. They just want short-term relief and long-term solutions. They have been tired by being sold a bogus bill of goods on energy for decade after decade. So when you can puncture something as a pander or a gimmick, that can blow back on you. And if the argument gets out that, you know what, this drilling plan isn't going to result in lower prices, I wonder if McCain, because, you know, Obama beats McCain in polling on who do you trust more on gas prices after the gas tax debate played out, I wonder if a similar thing might happen with this drilling issue.
Perhaps. I wonder how much people actually pay attention. I mean, we see the nuances and what people have said about it and what the, you know, economic research suggests. I wonder if people see that. You know, the vast majority of people, I think, have a very superficial relationship with politics. And so perhaps the only thing they see is tax cut on gas prices. I'm not sure they necessarily see any deeper.
Well, the other big debate between Obama and McCain this week was on terrorism after Obama was asked a question regarding habeas corpus. Obama responded that, you know, having the right to habeas corpus and having things done in a constitutional way worked out just fine for the 1993 World Trade Center bombers. They were able to be arrested, tried, and convicted in a legitimate way. The McCain campaign saw that as an opportunity to argue they have a 9-10 mindset. They don't want to prosecute the war on terror militarily. They want to process it like a law enforcement matter. And Todd Beaton over at MyDD, who was a Clinton supporter, has not always had the nicest things to say about Obama, had a very favorable assessment of how Obama responded, saying he's developed some very effective rapid response skills, hitting back on criticisms immediately. Thaw's response was swift and strong. With statements like Obama is sending, statements like this, Obama is sending several important messages. He won't be swift-footed. If you attack him, he'll go on the offense right back at you. And it's not like those other Democrats who shirk from a debate about 9/11 and national security. So you're not having this sort of crouching reaction, saying, oh, don't, not fair for you to talk about these things. He's saying, you want to talk about national security? You want to talk about who didn't get bin Laden? You want to talk about constitutional rights? Let's have it. When I talk to Khan about this stuff, I get a sense conservative bloggers always feel if the issue is national security, who cares about the details? McCain's going to win that argument. Is that still the impression?
I'm really not sure. I am very aware of the progressive argument that the Democrats do have an advantage in much polling, saying the public trusts them more. Again, I'm not sure. You know, polling can say a lot of things. How do people actually act? You know, the difference between stated preference and revealed preference. I think there are two things going on here. There's the top-level conceptual argument about how you should treat terrorism and the intersection between terrorism and warfare. There's also the more granular argument that about how Obama responds and how that resonates with the left roots. Do you want to take either one? I have comments about each.
I think there is a general appreciation, certainly in amongst liberal bloggers who have never been the biggest fans of Obama, at least those in the quote-unquote A-list. They are like, a little dubious of the bipartisanship rhetoric that he that he uses a lot. But they do like his general confidence. I mean, a lot of things that's always fueled the rise of the Netroots is a fight, wanting to infuse Democrats with a fighting spirit,
right,
and not feel you have to duck issues wherever they lie. You know, starting in 2002, Democrats always sort of felt, you know, national security is Republican turf. If we can make the issue about the economy, that's our turf. Let's talk about that. And that's a difficult play to make when you don't get to decide what issue is important to the voter all the time. If national security is on people's minds, you better have something to say about it.
I like to divide on the left and the right. Each has sort of a Price is Right theory of their issue. The right is on foreign policy and the left is on domestic policy. And each side feels that if they can just outbid the other on their policy, they'll win. The right feels like they can outbid the left on, you know, militarism or strength or military spending. And domestically, the left just feels like they can outbid the right. And I think both are fundamentally right. They can just outbid the other and appeal to the public desire to do something and the impression that activity equals vigor or success or compassion or strength. So, yeah, the left is waking up now to the idea that maybe the right has bid too far, and they're trying to exploit that. Getting back to the dynamic that Obama is exploiting here with the left roots, I like to say that what you said just now, the progressives, especially the left roots, want fundamentally what they want in their candidates, and especially the presidential candidate, is a fighting progressive. They want somebody who is unabashedly progressive and somebody who is going to stand toe-to-toe with Republicans and punch them in the mouth. The problem they had in this election was that with John Edwards, they had a fighting progressive, but I don't think they ever really thought he would be competitive, especially when he said he would take public financing. With Hillary Clinton, they had a fighting pragmatist, and with Obama, they had a kumbaya progressive. So no matter who wins or who would win, it was going to be a stylistic rejection to some extent. I'm sure you remember Obama going into the Coase Diaries and writing something once about how he disagreed with the style, the confrontational attitude. And he thought there were opportunities for bipartisanship or for listening to the other side, treating them respectfully, and there was a lot of debate about that. I think it can go one of two ways. Either Obama is going to try to be nonpartisan or try to be a little more conciliatory and respectful, and that's going to upset the left roots frequently, not always, but frequently. Or, and maybe he can do both of these, but or he is going to do the jiu-jitsu where he can turn around these arguments and punch back, and that's going to inevitably lead him into the permanent campaign style of vicious partisan warfare, which is going to create problems for him with the middle, but it'll certainly endear him to the left roots.
Well, that Daily Coast post that Obama did that you mentioned actually, I think, unnerved a number of bloggers on both fronts, that he wasn't going to be a fighter and he wasn't going to be all that progressive.
Yeah.
And some of those concerns still linger, but when you see a move like that on these national security issues, you know, that's, you know, it's always going to be a bit of a mixed bag from a liberal blogger's perspective, I think. But those moments are ones that make most bloggers feel more comfortable that he's going to be able to go toe-to-toe
right
going forward.
Yeah, things like this, I think Matt Stoller once said it was the bar fight mentality. You want somebody who will go in and get in a fight in a bar on your behalf. And then there's the top level issue of how this is going to resonate with the public. Are they going to perceive the Clinton administration approach of using criminal legal action, criminal law enforcement tools to deal with terrorism as a method that was successful during the 90s, or are they going to perceive this as an ineffectual sweeping under the rug method that led to 9/11? I'm not sure where the public feels about that. I guess, you know, it comes down to who can frame it and convey their message best.
Without re-arguing the Clinton record on terrorism, but I think after Obama staked his ground out on being willing to go into Pakistan to go after bin Laden if the Pakistani government wouldn't do it themselves.
Yeah, that was insane, by the way. Do you really want to go in and throw some bombs into a country that has nuclear weapons?
Well, it's not necessarily a question of bombs, but I do think it makes sense to go after bin Laden wherever he lies. And McCain took the stance that, as you say, that is a politically foolish thing to do. It becomes much harder to make the argument that you have a pre-9/11 law enforcement mentality, because you're arguing that he's being too militaristic. So I think it's going to be difficult to prosecute that case against Obama going forward.
Yeah, perhaps so. I think that the Pakistan thing might not be perceived as strength. It might be perceived as something either implausible or irresponsible. I mean, at the end of the day, you can send in missiles and bombs, or you can send in soldiers. And either way, it's an invasion or an attack on a sovereign country that is certainly a problem, but has nuclear weapons. You know, Bill Clinton in the 90s did not go after bin Laden in Afghanistan because he said you'd have to send a helicopter 900 miles across the border, and with very, very little probability of success or reasonable expectation of success, you know, you risk losing troops, the public, you know, the embarrassment on the international stage that could be a significant problem. I think that is exacerbated in Pakistan, and yeah, I'm not sure how the public will perceive it, but certainly the right and left will divide up into Obama is wonderful and Obama is irresponsible.
Well, Bush got a lot of mileage in 2004 saying that he was not going to let France veto our national security. He was not going to let other countries make our national security decisions for us. So I think it's going to be a lot harder to make an argument. And this is strictly politics. Obviously, I'm not discussing the substance of your argument there. But I think McCain has a tougher time making the case that we have to defer to another country in the whether or not we go after bin Laden full force, when at the same time he's saying, I'm going to chase bin Laden to the gates of hell. You know, which is it?
Yeah, it'll be very fun over the next few years to watch everybody play musical chairs, basically get up, walk around to the exact opposite side and say, huzzah, now I believe this. There's going to be a lot of that. There are going to be so many opportunities on the left and the right to go back and say, but in 2004 you said, and we as bloggers are going to have plenty of that record of our own as well.
I'm sorry, you're still there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I had a call waiting glitch.
Okay.
I apologize. Is it a good point to pivot to the next topic?
Yeah, swing state bounce.
So there's been all this expectation whether Obama would get a bounce or not in the polls. And there's some mixed evidence of that. But most recently, we had a series of polls from Quinnipiac. They've been tracking Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania going back into the primary. And those were states that generally Clinton was doing better than Obama in vis-a-vis McCain. And I think generally Obama had been trailing McCain, I think at least two of those states. But a fresh round of polls came out this week where Obama was beating McCain in all three, even Florida, which I think folks thought was going to be the hardest of the three for Obama to do well in. And there were differing analyses of that. 538.com, which got a lot of attention for its predictions during the primary, quote, if Florida is in play, then John McCain's defense is completely broken. It was the one traditional swing state that always had looked off limits to Obama. More frustratingly for McCain, he had spent the better part of 3 days in Florida earlier this month hoping to raise doubts about Obama among Jewish voters. Although Quinnipiac does not break out the Jewish vote, Obama holds a 61-31 lead in southeast Florida, where most of the state's Jewish population is concentrated. However, red states, the conservative site, played up the fact that Quinnipiac changed the methodology in these polls, focusing on likely voters for the first time. And therefore, they weren't as confident that their methodology for likely voters held water, and they thought the Florida result in particular seemed out of whack. Is there any sense in the conservative blogosphere beyond Red State that either these polls are an ominous sign, or are they going to be interpreted as more of an outlier?
Some sites, Red State and others, have said they're outliers or they don't mean much. I think the general attitude at this point, well, the general attitude everywhere, is to dismiss polls that aren't telling you what you want to hear. Of course, there's a lot of concern. I mean, Republicans have not exactly had a good record over the past however many months with treating Florida as the firewall state. People who did that tended to regret it. But I think the attitude is, you know, since when did people start buying polling data this far from the election? I mean, when McCain was doing well, the left was pointing out how unworthy early polling is. And Ezra Klein, even with this, pointed out, quote, as a general point, I probably won't spend a lot of time looking at who's ahead in individual national polls until the fall, until the conventions finish and people lock in their understandings of the candidates. The national numbers mean fairly little. So, I mean, I think the horse race people are watching it, and some of the underlying trends and specific data may mean a lot, but the large data, that might mean more about the early narratives that aren't going to mean much later.
Obviously, it's always true that early polling is rarely predictive. I do think early polling now is different than early polling in the past. You know, take, for example, you know, everyone looks at Michael Dukakis, who was up 16 points or so after he clinched the nomination in May of 1988. But at that point, he hadn't really suffered from any kind of conservative-style attacks, whereas in the Democratic primary, Obama received the same kind of attack lines, maybe not with the same exact wordage, with the same level of intensity, but those basic arguments were put out there, and he absorbed them. He definitely took somewhat of a hit in the polls. But if that's somewhat factored into baked into the cake already, and he's still up, I would think that would force the McCain campaign to question, wait a second, maybe we should try a different strategy here because these attack lines haven't done the job yet.
Maybe so. I think one of Obama's real problems is that he is a relatively new, fresh face. People are at this point able to project onto him what they want to see in him. We'll see if the right's narrative can defeat the left's defense of him. I don't think any of us have a really good sense of what the case is going to be. Part of his problem, though, is that he is a pop culture phenomenon. Pop culture phenomenons can, you know, last a long time, or they can crash and burn really fast. I don't know if he will alienate people in the general election, which is, you know, it's always a problem, or if he's going to remain the shiny,
hot
new thing.
I would think he's past the novelty stage at this point. If he was going to crash and burn, he would have crashed in the course of the primary.
He's past the novelty stage, but he's still pop culture, and you know, the public can turn on pop culture very fast. Now, I'm not saying that's a strategy, but I don't think the opposition has really had a chance to drill down on selling a single consistent narrative about him, and we'll see. I think ultimately early polling doesn't matter a lot because you're just rolling out the initial attacks to see what works, and it's going to take time for those attacks to you know, stick or not. And you know, the left is going to be telling stories about McCain, the right is going to be telling stories about Obama, and we don't really have a good sense of which stories will resonate, which maybe there will be a moment that makes one story resonate versus the other. That's just an unpredictable
variable.
Well,
speaking of one of those stories, one that I think a number of conservative bloggers jumped on was this incident in Michigan for the rally where Al Gore endorsed Obama, and there were two Muslim women in separate incidents who were told by Obama volunteers or staff that they had to move where they were seating so they wouldn't be in the shot, in the backdrop. Mm-hmm. And that was reported by Politico. The Obama campaign apologized right away, but it's still it was picked up by conservative blogs. There were a fair amount of mainstream media stories about it. do conservative bloggers think there's something here to drive and establish some kind of narrative?
You know, my impression really there is that they thought it was a funny story. It was what Mark Amender said, that there's a consequence to being too sensitive. Not only do your volunteers pick up on the vibes, they take it upon themselves to protect Obama, and in doing so, inevitably raise the very issue they seek to avoid. The Obama campaign has tiptoed along the tightrope of denying that he's a Muslim while making sure that Muslims know he thinks it's okay to be one of them. You know, it doesn't help that Obama refers to being called Muslim as a smear. It's, you know, probably not flattering to Muslims who don't think it's such a smear to be accused of being Islamic. And events like this sort of bring that into sharp relief. And this is not the first incident as well. I mean, as Hot Air and Ann Althaus had pointed out, there was an incident earlier where they were setting up a campaign scene, and one of the staffers said, "Get me more white people. We need more white people." So there's obviously a lot of sensitivity, perhaps too much, to enforce diversity on the Obama campaign and you know, ethnic group identity, which, again, could be one of those things that comes back and bites him. I think the right was generally gleeful at an opportunity to point out, you know, the effects of identity group politics. I'm not sure if a lot of people took it very seriously. They understand that it's an overzealous staffer.
I think the thing that's probably going to help Obama get past this and keep this a very limited story is, well, one, when talking about the smear, he is typically very careful to say it is not a negative thing to be a Muslim. He tends to make that point very explicitly. He calls it a smear because it's trying to play upon other people's anti-Muslim bigotry. And then makes the point right. That it's just simply inaccurate to call him a Muslim because he's not. And he has done, and the Obama campaign tried to put this out. They released photos of him with people in Muslim attire with him. They showed another rally, I think it was in Seattle, where there was a Muslim person in Muslim attire in the backdrop. So they can speak the argument, hey, this is not policy here. Not something that we do as a regular thing.
Yeah.
And make the case that this was an isolated incident. And presumably no volunteer or staff person is going to make this same mistake again. And I think because when this happened in the past, it wasn't a big deal. That those aren't the images that are being used to advance the smears, because it tends to be, you know, one person or two people in a crowd of people. It makes more of a diversity visual than it does anything that would be more insidious.
Well, you know, Joe Trippi said a couple years back that he was hopeful that we would soon be moving past the age of gotcha politics, and I think that was very hopeful and very optimistic and very ridiculous. I think we're going to, you know, see a lot of stuff like
I do wonder about that.
It's going to be frustrating and amusing.
I wrote a post back in January, which will presumably look extremely silly now, which I said, is this the end of code words? Because we had a couple of incidents in the Democratic primary where an attempt, or at least an impression or perception, of using racist or sexist code words or attitudes had completely backfired. It backfired on the Clinton team in Iowa, backfired on the Obama team in New Hampshire. And I was semi-hopeful that the campaigns would look at this and say, you know, you traffic in this stuff at your peril because it keeps backfiring. And I do think in the end, it ended up hurting the Clinton campaign a fair amount. I don't want to get into an argument about what was intentional, what was unintentional, but I do think there still is an impression there.
I don't think we'll argue about that. I think the whole code word thing is really oversold. Anytime there is a sensitivity and people are using natural language, not thinking about the potential implications, there are just tons of opportunities to bring that up and say, oh, they're trying to play on some irrational fear. Calling John McCain confused. Well, you can call every politician in the world confused. But with McCain, when you're using something that's sort of natural language, suddenly that's supposed to be a political attack. And the same thing is true with, you know, anybody who has a specific identity they're associated with. You know, Hillary Clinton is a woman, so when he says she is periodically upset, oh, that's an attack on her, a sexist attack. Well, you know, maybe, but I think that, you know, Lee Atwater gets criticized a lot for something he said in the 1980s, which in full context is actually, he was saying exactly the opposite. An interview in like 84 or something like that, somebody asked him, well, what do you think about the allegation that, you know, people use states' rights as a code word to energize the bigots. And he said, well, look, if you have gone from the point where you can outright say the N-word, and that's what you do to energize the bigots, to the point now where you have to use really, you know, you have to think through it to realize that that's a code word, things like states' rights, we've made a lot of progress. And his point was not that we use this word to energize the bigots. It was that, look how far we've come. That's progress. There is no you're really kind of stretching to say something is a code word now. You know, the Reagan opened in 1980 in Philadelphia thing is, you know, do you think people in 1980 in Philadelphia were really sitting there going, I know it. He's coming here because 16 years ago somebody was killed. That's a real stretch.
Well, I won't re-argue 1980, but
that would be the subject
but,
of another.
I think I might have mentioned this before. I think it's very interesting that Karl Rove has said, apparently publicly and privately, to other Republicans to not traffic in the Muslim smearing, because I think he's very cognizant of the concern of how that would appear. Concerned that the Republican Party can't sustain as an all-white party as the country changes demographically through the 21st century. And that message does not seem to be fully embraced by smaller conservative organizations or some of the state Republican parties. You still see isolated examples of either, you know, Muslim stuff or race-baiting stuff. And if that fairly or unfairly splatters on McCain and Obama wins, I wonder if that would at least help me be right in January that it will become more accepted that this stuff is bad politically, whether you do it blatantly, whether you get cute with it, whether you're just not being careful enough about what you're saying so people can make a false assumption about you, whatever it is, that kind of stuff is not going to be taken kindly by folks in the middle.
I certainly hope so. I've said this in the past. You know, people who use Barack Obama's full name, there's really only two reasons to do that. One, it's a legal document and you have to use his full name. Or two, you're just being a jerk. That's really the only excuse. The people who say, oh, I'm just using his real name. No, you're not. You're just trying to be a jerk. And I sincerely hope that more people internalize that.
Well, I have to jump because I have a radio interview I got to get to. So I feel bad. We're going to talk about the AP blogger controversy, so I apologize for leaving that on the cutting room floor.
Oh, it's okay. Let's wrap that up real quick. AP is wrong, and they're jerks for doing it.
I think there's wide agreement throughout the blogosphere, left and right, on that point.
Good man. Hey, it was really good to talk to you, and
I
enjoy this.
Take care.
Likewise.